This is the first Australian female-hosted surfing podcast, Amongst the Waves. I'm your host, Tanya Carroll, and I'm a surf coach, a Czech practitioner, and I'm completely caught up in all things surfing and getting to behind the scenes of surfing culture. I have surrendered my soul to becoming a better surfer. In each of the episodes of Amongst the Waves, I will bring you a perspective you might not have thought about before, in the hope that it entertains you and helps you learn something new. I also hope that it helps build your stoke. In this episode, my guest is Chris Mills. Chris is the owner of SurfStrengthCoach.com and creator of the Surf Athlete app. Professionally, he is a strength and conditioning coach, Czech practitioner, surf coach, remedial therapist, and has an extensive education in the realms of performance, training, and rehab. With a diverse background in health and performance and an obsession with surfing that errs towards a psychological issue, he has an integrative insight to surfing performance. Chris is involved in running and operating international surf coaching trips spanning destinations from Indonesia, Morocco, and Central America. He helps surfers understand their health and their fitness and their relationship with surfing.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. This morning, my guest with me is a guy I've known on and off online, I think probably for 10 years or so, Chris. Welcome to the show, Chris Mills.
Yeah. Thank you. And you're right, you know, 10 years, like my pseudo business partner who wanted to develop our app and everything, about a month ago, he's like, Chris, you're coming up on a decade of having done this whole surf strength coach thing. Wow. So you were right, like you nailed it. It's been like 10 years and like we are currently having like this whole 10 years sale and like advertise it, but it's been a decade, legitimately. It's crazy.
Tell us where you grew up and when you started surfing.
I grew up in Florida, so I was around the water in some capacity my entire life. And so surfing kind of came and went a lot. Even through my 20s would be big stints of lots of surfing and then not surfing for months and months at a time. High school started surfing more consistently, but I was doing a lot of skateboarding, lots and lots of skateboarding, and played a lot of soccer. And so those two things took a lot of time. And where we were, where I was living, was kind of almost Central Florida-ish, so a bit rednecky kind of.
Where in Florida was that? I've been to Florida.
So that was kind of like Plant City area. And then college, I did Tampa and St. Petersburg. When I was young, I lived in Cocoa Beach and Sarasota. So like right at the water. Right. All of growing up was always Florida and varying water interactions. And then through college, high school started surfing a lot more, college more consistently. But then even in college, there'd be big hiatus of surfing where I'd go live in Central America for like 5 months over summer and then come back to school and maybe surf four times over the next two semesters of school and back and forth and back and forth. And so that happened a lot. And it wasn't until probably mid to late 20s that I really started surfing a lot and fairly consistently.
Why do surfers do that? Because that's a really common theme that I hear. I've been in the world as a coach now for the last 2 years, 18 months, 2 years, but there is that, like,
sure.
At Urban Surf, we get a lot of people who are coming back to it for the first time, like guys who might've had family, and I can understand that, but why is it such a sport that seems to be in and out a lot?
I talk about this a lot with clients, and like, it is a very, to speak from my own perspective, mm-hmm. It is a very time consuming and life consuming endeavor, and very fickle at times in terms of its rewards. Like, so I don't have a family. I don't have a wife. I don't got kids. I got surfboard babies. And so my ability to throw myself at surfing is far different from somebody that's suddenly just entering a workforce and has a fiance, and those responsibilities suddenly become a lot more time consuming than shirking off work for the morning and trying to drive around for the next hour and a half checking spots. And it does become just this really potentially time consuming endeavor, but you can see that there's something deeper to it, like a soulful, metaphysical, energetic kind of thing, because people come back.
Right.
They always end up coming back to it, mm-hmm. and being like, wow, like there's this inherent draw. But you can also see there's a lot of people myself being one, and it sounds like yourself being one as well, have not derailed, not the right word, but routed ourselves through life to go after surfing.
Yeah.
Where other people, other things start to take priority, and surfing, you know, trickles away because of its demands. Whereas other people make choices about life based on their capacity to surf, which is something I've done and I'm sure you've done and a lot of listeners.
Do you think that wave pools, particularly, you've been to Melbourne, so you've been to Urban Surf, and I talk about that a lot because I'm a coach there, but do you think that is going to be changing, or I can see how that has changed the face of the way people surf? Like having access to...
their interaction, for sure.
Yeah.
100%. Like absolutely. So, you know, the couple of times I've been at the wave pool, just chatting with guys, like Melbourne, for example, you get a lot of East Coast guys that just fly in for the day and then fly out. Mm-hmm. Or guys down in Melbourne, like, they're like, oh, I didn't have, like, I was talking with a tradie there when I was surfing. He's like, oh, work got called off today because of some weather. So I came to the pool. There were some openings at the left. So whereas if we're a surfer and suddenly I have the day off and I'm like, oh, well, the winds are shit and there's no swell. So it's totally changed. And now they're going to be in every major city in the world, given another like couple of years.
Yeah.
So it will totally change somebody's ability just to surf and their time constraints. It would more easily fit in with somebody's life than the trek to the beach, the trek to find a bank, the trek to hopefully the swell works out, right. The winds meet. Yeah. You know, it just makes it, it's accessible. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The nature of it has changed for sure, but I think it's awesome.
I'm going to go back a little bit with you. What brought you to Australia and when? And I know that you worked with one of my very good friends, Leila Lutz, in Sydney.
Yeah.
What brought you to Australia and why?
When I was 21 or 22, I had just finished college and was getting, the path was to go to law school.
Right.
And
that's very different to where you are now.
Very different. And so working at a bar, I honestly don't recall what the catalyst was for me to want to visit Australia, but it was there. And so I was like, you know what? I'm not going to go to law school quite yet. I'm going to go do this backpacker thing in Australia. A buddy I was working with, he's like, I'll go to Oz with you if you go to Europe with me. So suddenly we went on this, like, we ended up traveling for a year and a half or something like that. So that was first foray to Australia. So I was 22, 23. And Australia is awesome. Coming from being interested in surf, and it's great. Like all the standardized comforts of living that I have from the States, you have in Oz, and Oz is just better in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Although I hate the speed cameras. The speed cameras do my head in. But
you're notoriously known for that online, yes.
So it just stuck in my head. And then yeah, at the time, so when I was 29, so I go back to the States, do, you know, my thing, start getting into the health field. And Australia was still offering year-long work holiday visas. So I came over on a work holiday visa at the age of 29. When I was about 30, met Leila, ended up working in Sydney for quite some time. And then that kind of started the life in Australia.
When did you transition fully
here
from?
Here we are 8 years later.
Yeah, 8 years later, wow. So you studied the Czech program, and that's how Leila and I had that connection, because we are both Czech practitioners, as are you.
Yep.
When did you transition fully from coaching? Because when I knew you in those early days, I knew you were a surfer, but I didn't really understand that that was your primary market. So when did that become your primary market, or has it become your primary market? Or do you do a combination of non-surfers and surfers in coaching?
Nowadays, I'd say probably 10 to 20% are non-surfers. All the rest are surfers. When I was going through, you know, the coaching, training, the intent was, I love this. There's certain aspects of training and coaching I don't really enjoy. I would enjoy it more if I could somehow integrate my passion of surfing with it. So I just started like being really bullheaded about it and starting this whole kind of social media thing years and years ago. And so over the course of many a year, it has come to the reality that most of my work now is centered around working with surfers in some capacity, whether it be training or rehab or coaching or something like that.
So it wasn't like a great big plan that you had that eventually this is what you were going to do, because I guess like you were one of the first people in that social media, using the social media platform at the time.
It wasn't necessarily the plan of like, it was what I wanted to do. And so I just started talking about it on social media platforms and just kept doing it long enough to the point where it finally did kind of coalesce into what it is nowadays. So over the years, it became somewhat of a plan. But I realized like me as a coach and a trainer, the only way I could really stay passionate about it was if I was to able to somehow bring in this whole kind of surfing thing to it. And I got lucky in that I was one of the first on social media to really kind of start doing it. Like YouTube back then, like I was one of the earlier ones. And so I just got lucky with that, you know, there was enough organic reach to propel me to where we are today that has kind of somewhat solidified me in that space.
Right.
So luck and a lot of kind of just perseverance with it.
What is the balance between your face-to-face clients and your online programs? Because how many programs online do you have? Is it just the one or is it multiple?
Oh, we've got quite a few. In the app, there's kind of multiple programs. It fluctuates. When I'm traveling, all the online stuff just devours me. And actually, it's been over the last year as the business has grown, 2 years, it's become quite difficult because a lot, I got into this because I'm a practitioner, one-on-one. Sure. Is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And as I've traveled, that becomes somewhat difficult just because, you know, you're in an area, you build up reputation, clientele base, and suddenly you move and it's, you're kind of scratching. So I've been able to buffer that with online work, but I have become indentured to my computer as of the last year or two with just running a business that is online, and it's become, it's chipping away at my soul and actual like enjoyment and fulfillment of doing it. Like really it's been difficult. Like I have to pull myself away from it.
Yeah.
So I try to balance it. Like, you know, I'm doing this now. I'll do a computer stuff for another hour or two. And then I'm seeing clients here locally this afternoon for a few hours. So I have to try to balance that out. Otherwise the computer work just zaps me.
Yeah, it takes for me, and I don't realize that it's, well, I'm getting better at realizing that it's happening, but it takes so much of my life force being online. And as much as I've had to adapt in the last like year and a half with COVID and switch to online coaching, and like I say, I enjoy it and I do enjoy it at the time, but at the end of the day, in comparison to the energy I've got left after coaching people face-to-face versus online, the difference is massive. In what it takes away from my energy. Yeah, completely different. And awful, not awful, but I know we have to adapt. And I know that COVID has changed the way we work, but I'm like you, I'm feel like I'm hands-on and physical and I need to be touching, feeling, smelling people.
It's exactly right. That's our skill capacity. That's why we got into this career path. Right. Like suddenly COVID changed the landscape of it. But we got into this career path because we didn't want to be at a computer and a desk. Right. Like that is one of the So suddenly, it's an incredible opportunity for us to still be able to work in some capacity, but it's not necessarily enriching. It's still great to be able to engage. Like I love the stuff I do online with clients for sure.
Yep.
But it is not at all personally fulfilling in terms of this is exactly what I want to be doing. Like, you know, it's not that we're begrudging it at the slightest, but we have to be aware of our own kind of energetic needs and just requirements of happiness. And it can be tough at times because like you said, we're one-on-one. I want to see, touch, feel, personally interact with you. That's what we are as practitioners.
Exchange that energy. Have you done holistic lifestyle coaching in the Czech program or have you just done practitioner?
Yeah. I've only actually ever done level one. I wanted to do level two. It just never, it ended up not coming about. And so I just went hard on the practitioner route for the most part.
Right. And you've done DNS as well. And for people who are listening who don't understand what that is, that's dynamic neuromuscular stabilization.
I have dipped some toes into some of the initial courses of DNS, yes.
If you're anything like me, yeah. DNS comes from very much, however we say it, a education background, in terms of they only let people into their practitioner side of their courses if you've got a university degree or are in a university degree. So have completed or are mm-hmm. doing one at the moment. And I know I've been banging my head against their wall for the last 8 years to try and get into their practitioner side of things, because I think the gold is in those. I'm hoping they'll break those walls down eventually and let us do those too. But
I reckon it will. And especially now that, you know, me from the primary, my biggest educational influence has always been Czech Institute, especially Susie Neville. Like, yeah. Susie Neville directed my trajectory with like how I want to practice. And so then, you know, DNS is great. And I want to take more, because all I've taken are their intro courses, and it's not, it hasn't been enough of a picture for me to really start to integrate it. And so everybody I've spoken to, the higher court or exercise 2 and 3 or DNS level or BCD,
yep.
starts to get into a lot more of the rotational capacities and kind of dynamic stuff, which I bet is where the gold is. But then I also see it like, you know, the surf world is latching onto it because Chris Prosser is DNS. He's WSL.
Head of medical team, yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, DNS is becoming really influential in the surf world, which right. I see is likely a great thing, but, you know, it's like you've been in the field long enough to see the coming and going of different influences of therapy or treatment. So like in the States at the moment, PRI is huge, huge. And that's been steamrolling for about a decade. Most in Australia don't even know what PRI is.
I was gonna say, what is
Postural Restoration. Postural Restoration Institute. And the guy that created it, Ron Hruska, he's like an alien brain, like Paul Check. Like yeah. Where did you come from? Like, And so that's a huge thing over there, where suddenly we're seeing this resurgence of DNS here in Australia mm-hmm. in the surf world. But then you go back 10, 15 years and it was Czech was really big in the surf world in Australia, not so much in the States. So, you know, for me as an outside perspective and kind of having a voice in the surf world, I'm like, cool, Dave, let's see where it goes. Let's see what we can integrate. Let's see the influences of it. But I would like to take more of the courses. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And that was the reason that I brought it up, because it is so big in the surfing world. And I think as a practitioner, it being a Czech practitioner coming into the surfing world, like I said, I'm relatively green in the surfing industry in the surfing circles, not so much in the corrective exercise because I've been doing that for 16 sure. years. But coming in and having the Czech name, I thought would be a little bit more recognized than what it is. People still don't understand that Mick Fanning is still training with a Czech practitioner on the Gold Coast. But yeah. DNS is very yeah. much is more door opening for me, I think, than what the Czech name was, which is really interesting.
Yeah. And you know, that'll all ebb and flow like over the next couple of years again. But
yeah. Like you said, it'll come and go. And when people find a reason to use a particular modality, or a practitioner finds a reason to use that particular modality, then it will become popular and it comes in and out. Whereas people like you
exactly
and I
right.
use all of those methods or what those methods within our practice continuously.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Spot on.
So my next question is, who buys your programs online and what is your balance between men and women in your coaching? Like, do you have more men than women?
Yeah, I'd say overall more men. I know online, demographic wise, we sell more to men. Or if we're speaking like insights of data and you know what we're looking at, 35 to 50 year old men is who we sell most stuff to. And I'd say personally, in terms of clientele, that's probably the majority bell curve of who I work with. And then women buy all the programs as well. It's just our, I guess you could probably say our marketing has been more masculine than feminine in that regard.
Absolutely.
And so one of the big things, my business partners like me, we need to start doing more female marketing. And I have a lot of women even reach out to me. They're like, is your program okay for women? I'm like, surfing doesn't dictate, like, your surfing doesn't change if you're a male or a female. But so like, we're even looking into like, maybe I need to hire a female to make programs with her that are just my programs, but it's a female doing it. And then suddenly, you know, it becomes more accessible in those terms. I would say on trips, coaching trips, we probably are 60-40, 40 females, 60% males. And we could easily work with more females in that regard. I would say, funnily enough, we did an all-female trip a couple years ago, and I don't think we would do an all-female trip ever again.
Why is that?
That became well, you know, you got like three male coaches and then a boat full of females. We learned a lot from that trip, and that how we might need to change things in terms of how information is delivered and the coaching processes are delivered. But what we have found on coaching trips, especially boat trips, that if we can have a mixed group, it totally changes the emotional demographic of that trip to a lot more chill, in a sense. Whereas if we go all female, there's a lot, the emotions are, you know it, surf coaching eventually often becomes some type of emotional coaching. That's what it is.
Absolutely.
And so if you got a boat full of women, exactly. So if we can just kind of get a mix on the boats, it just kind of mellows things out a bit. You got the yin yang balance of male, female on there. So it makes it a bit easier.
That's very interesting. Which level of surfer are you coaching in? Like, are you coaching from learn to surf right through to intermediate to advanced, or are you just doing that intermediate to advanced area?
Me personally, the niche is kind of the intermediate. Mm-hmm. Boat trips and coaching trips, we're usually, again, in that intermediate spectrum, but intermediate's a big spectrum. Like, I would only consider myself an upper level intermediate surfer, just in terms of getting into the spectrum of how the terminology uses a deeper conversation. But so my personal coaching, technique-wise, skill-wise, I'm not there to coach advanced surfers. I understand the technique. I can see it. I don't feel that I should coach skill and technique if I can't do it and I'm not there. So personally, if we're working just on technique and skill, a lot of that spectrum of intermediate, and I'm happy to work with beginners, especially like just instilling some of the initial kind of fundamentals. But personally, it's just not my preferred scope of coaching in that beginner realm. And then with the actual coaching trips we run, those are predominantly more the spectrum of intermediate, with from lower being a bit different than the advanced intermediate in terms of which trips we're doing. But it's within that spectrum where I think my kind of bread and butter lies.
What do people mostly come to you for one-on-one coaching?
Pain.
Yeah.
A lot of pain related stuff is probably the biggest one. Lately there's been a lot more, actually with the wave pools, I'm doing a lot of video analysis online. I would say the low intermediate spectrum. A lot of guys out of the UK getting a lot of footage now. So that low intermediate spectrum surfer, just like, what am I doing wrong? What do I need to start working on, kind of thing. And then a lot of guys, you get it, surfers, necks, shoulders, low backs, like myself included, like just trying to keep this body doing what it needs to do and still being capable of surfing. So I'd say it's with the one-on-one stuff, a lot of kind of pain and training related around that.
Getting onto that subject, because I know you've been very vocal about, or not vocal, but you've been authentic about the injuries you've had, and I've known you through some of those injuries. So you've had the neck whiplash, but then you had the broken leg as well, didn't you?
Broken ankle a couple of years ago. Yeah.
How do those injuries, or have those injuries changed the way you coach and your programs?
I would say, one, any injury you as a practitioner can go through, just like helps you to level up. Like you just have to learn some more. So in that regard, it's been great. They suck going through them, but as a learning tool, it's great. And all of that information will eventually get distilled into a client at one point or another. Mm. I would say as I've gotten older, so I'm 38 now, I'll be 39 this year. As I've gotten older, accrued injuries and keep going after surfing, it's definitely changed my appreciation and wanting to teach people how to really start finding the balance that works for them in terms of wanting to surf, but really still having to like look after themselves and understanding that if they want to keep surfing well and progressing through their 40s, 50s, mm-hmm. they have to start prioritizing looking after themselves. Like it has to, 20s, 30s, you can get around just kind of like being a little slack with it. Mid 30s beyond, like it has to start really becoming a priority. Otherwise, your surfing is going to start just falling off, whether in terms of its skill or your just ability to move. Feel good in the water physically. Right.
And to the injury recovery and that sort of thing as well. So do you think then that we need to be starting earlier? So if we're looking at people who are wanting to surf for a long period of time, do we need to start talking to the people in their 20s and 30s? Or do you think it would just be like, they wouldn't listen anyway?
I don't think they'd listen. Like I people that are already athletically inclined like would listen, but they would still, you know, you look at a lot of training programs, so do I. Like the 20s can still get away with like CrossFit-esque training and that kind of higher intensity and higher volumes, whereas suddenly you get into 30s, 40s for sure, suddenly it's like, why am I going after high intensity volume? Like I tell my clients, like your heavy outputs, yes, we can train, we can prepare, but stop going intensely hard at your training because you might have to go surf tomorrow. Like right. Start to balance the intensities. Where do you want to throw your efforts? And so I think, you know, in their 20s, people might start to listen. They can at least be smarter with their training, mm-hmm. like a more focused intent and just smarter application of exercise. And then in their 30s, you know, people start paying attention because I have a lot of clients early 30s that wanting to surf have been some type of career path since like 23 to 25. So they've been at a desk now for multiple years and starting to realize, oh, things are starting to, you know, not feel well. So they're having their light bulb moments, ready to tune in.
What are the things that you teach or that you coach outside the ocean or outside of surfing to help support their health?
I mean, nutrition, as you know, that's primary nutrition and just the basic kind of the biggest thing, not that this isn't the biggest thing that I wrongly stated that, but really trying to get people to understand how to undulate their training based on their output, right? So it's the whole stress bucket thing, like the accumulation. Right. So I've had guys write me about my program. There's one video in my programs onboarding them before they start training where I start talking about balancing their surfing and their training and just seeing it all as seesaw and undulation. And they're like, that just suddenly that was their epiphany. And I'm like, how would you not realize that before? But you know, we take that stuff for granted.
Right. Because we've been doing it for as long as we have and it comes as second nature to us. But, yeah.
Exactly. And so it's the biggest of like just starting to undulate their training or their intensities based on all their inputs being sleep, nutrition, recovery, and surfing. So surfing takes priority unless there's a rehab or a specific goal training at hand. Mm-hmm. So surfing takes priority up. There's no swell until Friday. So then Monday through Thursday, do some smart aspects of training. And then when the surf's up, surf and just start learning how do I feel today? I feel pretty damn good. Okay. Then train. You don't feel too good. You're a bit tight. Then drop off the training, work on some recovery. Cause at the end of the day, like we've got this body for hopefully several more decades and our intent is to surf, not to chase numbers in the gym.
Right. And that goes back to that conversation we were having before we got online here, or before we started recording with you, when I said you're not surfing today, and about the 12-foot swell.
Yeah.
Like, do I really need to go out in that today? Probably not.
Yep. That's it. So like the net thing came back because, I mean, I knew something was going to come back in a sense, because I surfed for like 6 days straight, multiple sessions a day at times. And so it's this accumulation.
Yep.
And so, perfect example, I have a guy, a client, kiteboarder, and I've been working with him for a while, and he goes hard at everything in life.
Yeah.
And he texts me and he's like, oh, my back, da 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 da. I'm like, okay, so what's the previous last couple of days been? He's like, oh, well, I've trained the last 6 days and I've kited also sometimes twice a day. So I'm like, okay, you've trained every day and kited and sometimes multiple kiting sessions per day, but you don't know where this back thing came from. And so to him, totally oblivious to that accumulation of output. And I'm like, dude, what do you expect? Like, and so it is that kind of understanding of, you know, you go super hard all the time. Something's going to creep back into previous injury, an old nerve thing. You got more inflammation, whatever. So it's just that awareness of how to shift.
As a practitioner, because I know I do it to myself as well, I've actually hurt my supraspinatus this week getting out of my heat seeker wetsuit. So not when I was in the water. Like getting out of it because it was tight and I'd let myself get too cold, and then like trying to reef my shoulder out. So it's stupid injury, but I think we are the best. Stop laughing at me, Chris. We are the best examples of how to listen to your body and to like you said, those old injuries will come back up. That's not an old injury. That's a new one for me. But I know that my knee injury that I have starts to recur if I'm not doing enough of the recovery and not doing enough of the nutrition. And I think we're a great example for our clients of what to do and what not to do sometimes.
100%. Like, you know, guys, I get them on our boat trips and I'm straightforward. I'm like, you guys are on a 10 or 12 day surf marathon. Mm. You are going to hurt. Like it is not, you are throwing yourself at an output that your body is completely not conditioned for, unless you happen to be surfing every day where you're coming from. Mm. And your old injuries, so mine's my neck and low back, those are going to start being the first signals, right? And so start being aware, and so, you know, those old things, they come back, and it's just, you know, my neck and low back kind of steer a fair bit of my training. I know those are the things I kind of have to bulletproof in a sense. And those are the first signals that the body is getting fatigued and they're starting to rear their head. So yeah, on surf trips, like, oh, guys are like, oh, my back. I'm like, well, it's been going on for 10 years and you've surfed for in a total of like 15 hours over the past like 4 days. And you wonder why your back's a little sore. Like,
yeah, no wonder.
Can
we switch to talking about injuries on the CT and the QS?
Yeah.
What do you see as the most ankles. Common injuries? Yeah, straight up ankles.
Ankles and knees. I had an interesting conversation a while back. Who was it with? I think it was a coach. I think we're almost at a point where we're going to start seeing a cap in certain levels of professional surfing, like John, for example, like
with his knee. Yep.
Though. Yeah. And once those type of things start and you're subjecting your body to trying to land 6 foot boosted airs in 8 foot surf, that's a lot of load on tissue. Right. And so we're almost at a point where pro surfers, their paychecks rely on them being able to surf most often. So you're going to probably see them not being able to go as hard or as huge all the time, just because who wants to shatter an ankle and be out for the rest of their CT season and then lose half of their sponsors?
Right.
So,
and the sport doesn't want that. The WSL doesn't want that either, because that's probably the pinup person for that year. Yeah.
It's exactly right. Exactly right. So, you know, it's professional. It's not capped in terms of its skill, but a lot of the big guys in terms of competition, it's the airs. It's the air game that often results in like a lot of those injuries. But, you know as well as I, surfing from a biomechanical perspective ain't friendly on the body. Like, you know, a good surf stance, you've got low back, that rear leg, like, you know, you've got all sorts of tibial external rotation, weird valgus, like, you know, most surfers don't have enough hip internal rotation anyways. And like, so it's,
so they tear the labrum
style. It's it. It's exactly right. 100%. And so, you know, from a biomechanical perspective, it ain't friendly. And then you start putting huge forces through those joints, things are going to go.
Gosh, yeah, I'm really happy to talk to you because I see that happening, and I see that just in the wave pool about how much stress they put on their bodies. And they, I get frustrated sometimes because I come like you from the perspective of corrective exercise, and I understand the love to want to keep doing the thing, but if you can't, like, where's the balance between fucking your body up completely and still doing it for as long as you can and loving the sport? Like, there's that a very fine balance there, and people are. I would love to educate more people around how we maintain both, like without messing our bodies up completely.
It's a tough one. Like, it's a tough one. And there's not, this is kind of a tangent, but it was an epiphany. Like, so, you know, I'm starting to push towards 40.
And you sound like that's really you're making it sound like old.
Not in the least, but it's suddenly a number where you're like, okay, yeah, this whole life thing is, the trajectory doesn't stop. And so I'm looking at, okay, nearly 40. So I've got, you know, you can surf well into your 50s, but I'm like, all right, I've got 10, 12 years before 50 to really like throw myself towards the heavier waves that I want to surf in the world and to still go after like heavy trips to wherever. And so I'm like starting to get an idea or just a conceptualization of my body's still capable of this. I know surfing and surfing at a high level and well isn't necessarily biomechanically friendly. I already have these injuries. How much time do I have to still really throw myself towards more intense surfing? And to do that with an awareness of like my body can keep doing it. Because there ultimately kind of comes a point where performance, it depends how somebody, their definition of performance, but there might come a time where, you know, you have to shift what surfing is for you based upon what your body is capable of. So what type of equipment can I ride? What type of waves can I ride with that equipment? Because you'd see it just like I, like once guys' hips go or their low back goes, suddenly you have to start changing equipment. And once you start changing equipment, you're changing the wave or where they can surf the wave or what type of wave they can surf. So suddenly that shifts their surfing. And so it's kind of a come to the surf Jesus moment where it's like, make some decisions about where you're going to go with it and what you can do with it. Because the biomechanics of it aren't necessarily the nicest.
No. And what's realistic for your life and what you want to get out of your life and out of surfing as well, and how it contributes to the mental health of your life, because those things are all really important things. Because I know lots of surfers, and I talk to a lot of more mature men who come into the park, like I said, who come back to it after not surfing for a while, and they'll come out of the water like halfway through a session of an hour, first hour session, and they're completely wrecked. And I'm like, how are you going? They're like, that is the toughest thing I've ever surfed. Like, and it's not because of the shape of the wave or it's because of the intensity of how many waves you can catch. And they get all hyped up and excited and they want to go out, and they go out hard and try and catch every wave of the set. And then halfway through, they're just exhausted. But, the mental health side of things, I think, is really, because I work in what's called the WOW program, the Waves of Wellness program here at Evansurf, which is run down the east coast of Australia. And it's like the benefits that I knew about surfing before I got into it and versus now what I can see and what I witness through people being in that particular program is huge. Like, if we could get more people into the water to experience that is massive. So balancing out the biomechanical problems that come from it, possibly for the body as you age, versus the benefits you get in terms of mental health, I think is a really interesting area that is just being tapped into now.
That's, you know, like you said, that's the reason you and I know firsthand the potential mental health implications of surfing. Mm. And also the mental health implications of suddenly having surfing stripped away from you due to an injury or some type of exactly. And it's powerful. And that's why you see people often coming back to surfing later in life and realizing, oh, wow, like this is what I was missing. Mm. And so, you know, again, from us both being in the wellness and health space, like you see guys suddenly lose surfing for quite some time or lose their capacity or like a hip thing or back thing. So suddenly they can't even get to their feet, like, or they're an injury. And so they can't be in the water for 8 to 12 months or whatever it might be. Like it is an emotional trauma. And something that was a piece and part of who they are and relied upon for some of their mental well-being is stripped away. Mm. That's heavy. That's really heavy.
Yeah. Where do you see surfing going in the future? Just to change the subject yet again. Like, where do you see the advancement of it in terms of athletics? And I'm bringing this up because I wanted to ask you, what's your opinion on having surfing in the as an Olympic sport? And how is that going to change the face of the way the population who maybe thought of surfing as being something that layback bums do just for fun and not necessarily a career? Do you think it will change that? Big question.
I think surfing in the Olympics is going to be incredible. Yeah. I think surfing in the Olympics is going to be epic. Like the face of surfing's already changed over the last 10 years. Like the trajectory of surfing has been exponential growth. And so I don't even think we really know. It's still in its fledgling. Like who knows where it's going to go? Mm. And the only wave pools are going to be, like we said, every major city in the U.S., surf destinations just keep getting horribly more and more crowded, like less fulfilling.
Yes.
So in that regard, like the soul of surfing is still there, but like the majestic aspect of it that a lot of us chase is starting to kind of change. Right. In terms of it being in the Olympics, it's epic. Like it's going to, I would be curious to see how it plays out in terms of, because are they doing it in a pool or are they doing it, do they have like a 3-week window at a break that they're, I don't even know how.
I don't even know that either. Like I have, I'm not sure.
Yeah. I'd be curious to see like, you know, where that goes because you see like Slater wave pool competitions. Mm-hmm. I think it's epic in certain regards, but it's a very different competitive scenario than it is, you know, a surf at any other reef or ocean break. Exactly. Very different. So I think we're going to see probably a trajectory of different avenues of surfing over the next couple of years. So being in the Olympics, going to catapult the recognition. You're going to see a lot more, you know, what you and I are doing is going to explode. Like, look what's happened on social media in terms of surf fitness just in the last like 3 years. Like,
yeah, it's incredible.
So that's going to keep, it's incredible. Yeah, that's going to keep growing. You're going to see more and more wave pools. You're going to start seeing surfers that only surf wave pools. And suddenly that they're going to realize that that doesn't translate to the ocean just from the simple aspect of being able to read and perceive waves. But I think the whole surf industry is going to keep growing. I just don't know where. Mm. It's going to keep getting bigger for sure. But you know, it's still changing. Like, look, all the major manufacturers, a lot of them went bankrupt the last couple of years, you know, or near bankruptcy. And so this whole face of what surfing is going to kind of keep changing over the next couple of years. And it's a good thing. It's totally a good thing. It's a bad thing for surfing waves that are uncrowded potentially.
Well, that's the eternal argument really, isn't it? About, because, I talked to, Damo, who is the CEO of Urban Surf last week. And it was actually, it wasn't on that. It was on a podcast that I was watching with James. No, it was a one of Kale's videos that he did with James, who works at Urban Surf, who's our he's in charge of our events. But he was saying we have to be careful in terms of the people that we coach in the pool and making sure that they understand that the lineup and the etiquette, like we coach very heavily in etiquette, but that's very different to what you see in localism outside, like at any beach. And I've heard this and experienced this myself, but particularly for women. So if we're coaching them in the water and the lagoon and they build up their confidence, and then I say, well, go down and like they go down and surf at one of the local breaks, and it's completely different. Sure. So we have to, I think there's going to be a balance between the athletic side of it, or the athleticism of being coached in a wave pool versus in the ocean, because like, you know, it's different, but also the stuff that surrounds the culture of surfing. We have to be very careful about integrating it and making sure that they understand that it's a different ball game when you're out there on your own. And I think that's different one of the game. Things. Yeah. One of the things that kept women particularly out of the water is that, and myself included in that, but yeah, I don't know that we're going to change, and I know it's not going to happen very quickly, the localism side of it accepting those people who have learned to surf in a wave pool and then them coming out into the ocean, because I think there's still very much a separation there.
A Facebook group I belong to, somebody asked something about localism, like, what do you think of it? Does it need to be there? And I responded out succinctly. I was like, look, this is a really nuanced conversation. Long response, very short, because it's Facebook. I wish aspects of localism could have a resurgence. And there needs, I would like to see not as hardcore as it used to be in like the 80s and 90s, but like, you know, you think of like the Wolfpack scenario in Hawaii or something. I would like to see more of a checks and balances at more surf spots. Just if somebody needs to be called up on their bullshit, it's going to happen. And the reason this really got cemented into me was me spending a lot of time in Indonesia and seeing the chaos that takes place down at like across a lot of Indo or Bali predominantly, of people that are new to the sport, have no conceptualization of hierarchy, have no understanding of actual etiquette. And I was like, man, a lot of these people need to get punched in the fucking head and told to leave the lineup. Because it's, and that sounds really rough, but it doesn't always need to be that intense, but there needs to be, I would like to see some type of a graded process. I can say this because I travel all over the world and surf
everywhere,
small rural breaks to big known breaks. And I don't ever have issues because I'm not a dickhead and I know the process, and I start chatting with the local dudes, get nice, don't take any of their way. You know what I mean? There's this process to it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people go into it and they're just oblivious to it. And it starts, especially in Bali, it becomes dangerous depending on the break that you're surfing with the reef and everything. So with, and it is unfortunate that surfing is a very ego-driven kind of this is mine, dog-eat-dog kind of scenario, but you know, everybody wants their waves. But that's not to be said. You could have a checks and balances and a type of hierarchy, but still be cool and respectful and polite and fun, but just well aware of the process to it. And you know, I'm showing up at this new break, I've never been here before, I'm gonna watch and sit in the back and take some scraps, and if I'm here for the next couple months, I'm gonna work on it. You know what I mean? Like I think that needs to have somewhat of a resurgence, but you can't go around and punch people in the head anymore because you get it videoed and then you're sued. So,
but also that, like, but like, I understand where you're coming from, and I understand that people who have surfed those local breaks have earned their stripes, for lack of a better term. Sure. Like, they've done their time there. They know what that reef is like. They know where to get on the wave, and you've got to respect that. But I think there's got to be some sort of balance of the understanding from the new person coming in to going, okay, I respect that. And the understanding of those locals going, it's not just like they can't own the ocean, they can't own that break, they can't own that reef, because sure. no one owns nature, and there's going to be plenty of waves. Like yeah. I think I come from the other perspective, from going, well, why are they fighting so hard for something that they don't own? Like, I get it. They've surfed there, all that sort of thing, but there's plenty of ocean to share, and there's plenty of waves. And just because yeah. there's like you surf in that space doesn't mean you can't let other people in, because you can learn from those people and they can learn from you. And I think that's life. Like, if we all work.
Well, sure. Together, but then, you know, the aspects of localism, if they're surfing that local spot and they've been doing it for 10 years, and let's demographically bell curve say they're probably an older male.
Right.
And that spot, that surfing, it's part of their identity. It's mm-hmm. part of their ego, right? And so suddenly somebody is infringing on their ego, and it starts to become this, you know, chimpanzee gorilla-esque hierarchy, who's the silverback, and this dominance. And so it's an unfortunate aspect of surfing, this kind of male-driven, egotistical, this is mine, it's not yours, I'm gonna throw my excrement at you because this is a chimpanzee behavior. It's unfortunate, you know?
Yeah.
But there's also, and then it is tough, like, because I've dealt with situations like that in bizarre places where it is like Bali, and it's just some older white dude on a Balinese break, and he's only lived here for 2 years, and he thinks this is his spot. And you're just like, man, this is so weird. What is your deal? What is wrong with your life that this is where you're establishing your dominance? But yes, I totally get where you're coming from. It's a weird push-pull. But you know, me growing up as a skater in the 90s, skate parks were localized, and they had a set of local crew. Whereas now, especially in Australia, every neighborhood has a skate park. It's a bunch of little kids on scooters and stuff. Whereas 20 years ago, that wasn't happening at all.
It's
transitioned.
Yeah.
No. And so you're going to keep seeing it transition. The issue where I really am okay with localism is if it's a heavier wave and there's aspects of some danger.
Right.
Keep things. Yeah. But yeah, if it's just like some silly little beach break and like whatever, like, come on, get over yourself. Like, go find, you know, throw your ridiculous attempts at ego dominance somewhere else in life.
Yeah, step into your higher mind and start thinking differently. Some people just don't, yeah. With the education that you and I have, sometimes that is not a common thing for people to understand that. Yeah.
No.
Then that's a whole other conversation. One last topic of conversation, and then I'll let you go. But I heard Dave Proden talking on his latest podcast about the thought that we might have athletes coming through who've only surfed in wave pools. And do you think that there will be, and I'm asking you something that none of us really know, but there's the potential there to be a division between wave pools and ocean surfing completely, because people might start making enough money in competitions in wave pools. Like you said, if they're all around the world, they might find that they don't need to do the ocean surfing, that they can build a career just in wave pools.
I think you're spot on. I almost mentioned this earlier, actually. Again, you can look at skating, like there's aspects of just vert skaters versus mm-hmm. just street skaters versus, you know, and you'll see this differentiation. I think that is very likely, if there's money behind it, you're going to for sure see it. And it also, I think, comes down to, yes, I totally agree with you. You're going to likely see a differentiation. But then with a lot of people coming up, if you get really good at a wave pool, that again isn't necessarily going to transition out to the ocean. And the only reason being is because if you've only grown up or developed surfing wave pools, your reference points, like your mental models of that wave, are limited to what that wave is rather than the variable aspects of the ocean. Mm-hmm. And so a pro that has grown up just surfing raw surf all the time, their mental model is able to quickly infer, this is the spot where I need to do this because this is the curve, this is the refraction. They see all these angles because surfing is being to interact, to know when to do the turn and where. Whereas on the wave pool, once you get the wave figured out, it's often the same thing each time. Mm-hmm. And so it will ultimately, one necessarily won't directly translate to high. If you get really good just in wave pools and haven't surfed the ocean much, it will be a harder transition versus the other way.
Right.
But yeah, I think you're going to see more and more wave pools and you'll probably start seeing a wave pool circuit. I wouldn't doubt that.
Oh yeah. I don't doubt that either. Within the next 5 years, we're seeing that already.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you would like to talk about before we finish up? Or is there anything else that you would like to say in regards to what we're doing?
I don't think so. For anybody listening, I have an app, the Surf Athlete app. Go download it. It's free.
It's awesome.
There's paid programs in it. I don't think I have anything else to necessarily say. Like, do you have any ending questions? I thought that was a good conversation.
What was that?
A good tangential conversation. I like that.
Awesome. Where's your favorite place to surf and where would you never surf again? Two questions to finish up with.
Morocco was epic. Ooh. Morocco was, in terms of surf and just the rest of travel, you know, everything else that comes with it, the food, the geography, Morocco was astounding. It'd be so weird. Like you'd be basically like right hand point breaks, then you turn around and look back at the land and it looks like Mars. Like it's so, the dichotomy of it was so, and the food, like tagine, like I am always one for slow cooked meat for sure.
You are.
And so like the tagines are just, so Morocco is absolutely awesome. A trip that I wouldn't do again, honestly, I don't think there's really been any destinations that have been totally abysmal. Like I probably wouldn't intentionally go back to Florida just to surf. Florida can get good by all means, but it wouldn't be high up on all the surf destinations I could take. And usually the only reason for like surf travel that got rough was either a lack of surf or like some type of gut infection or something that came along.
Yeah.
But outside of that, like I haven't had any like really horrible surf travel. Like in Sumbawa, I got typhoid. That sucked really terribly.
Yeah. That took a long time for you to recover from.
Some gut infection.
Yeah.
Oh man, it's still like that one was heavy. I still have residual effects. Like my body's really weird with sweating still. Mm. Like I try to tell doctors it feels like it altered my internal thermostat. My body doesn't know how to regulate temperature like it should anymore. Mm. And so that's weird. But Morocco is incredible. If anybody ever has a chance, you can get skunk too. Like you need some swell to push to light those point breaks up.
Yep.
But as a whole, Morocco is absolutely astounding. Like I can't wait to go back there. I still really want to do Mexico. Surprisingly enough, I haven't really spent much time in Mexico.
I was going to say, is there one place that you want to go that you haven't been yet?
South Africa, for sure. South Africa and Mexico are probably the big ones. And then I still haven't done Cloud Break. I'd like to get over there for sure at some point. So there's definitely still some surf travel that needs to take place. So again, like, you know, coming up on 40, need to get it done over the next decade or so.
Make a plan. Thanks very much for being with me today, Chris. This has been really good. Good conversation.
Thank you, Tanya. Yeah. Cool. Cheers.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Amongst the Waves. I would love for you to leave your review on Apple Podcasts. Reviews help increase our rankings, let more people listen to the podcast, and share the love.